Welcome everybody to lesson 6 of Survival of a Nation. This is our 6th and final lesson, which is always bittersweet, but we like to focus on the sweet and not the bitter. Bittersweet obviously because this is the last session of this series, but we have in store today this one. We've been saving the best for last. All right, I want to begin with a story. There was a fellow who was not friendly of the Jewish people who walks into a bar. Classic anti-Semite. He walks into a bar, and there he sees near the bar a Jewish religious-looking fellow with a kippah, the whole nine yards. He gets very upset. So he turns to the bartender and he says in a loud voice, "I'm ordering for everyone in the bar a round of drinks on me except for that man." The bartender does it. He serves everyone drink. It takes a few minutes. And after a few minutes, everyone has their drinks. The Jewish guy makes eye contact with this anti-Semite and he smiles. The Jewish guy does, and he says, "Thank you. Thank you. I mean, thank you." He's so upset now. He's really angry. So he says, "You know what? I'm got to do this again. The message didn't come through." He goes up to the bartender and says, "Another round of drinks on me."
For everybody except this guy.
Except the Jewish guy. So bartender pours drinks for everybody else. And he's feeling good about himself. He's feeling good. And the Jew makes eye contact again, smiles and says, "Thank you." At this point, he is beside himself. He doesn't know what to do. He goes over to the bartender and says, "What is wrong with this guy? Twice I've ordered drinks for everybody. Twice I've excluded him. Why is he smiling? Why is he saying thank you?" He says, "Oh, you mean Yankel over there? Yankel? Oh, he owns this place." All right. There you have it. See, since he owned the place, he was happy that the guy was... joking. I'm not going to explain the joke. So, today, our discussion touches on anti-Semitism and Jew hatred. Unfortunately, it is not a new thing. In fact, perhaps it can be said that it's one of the world's oldest pastimes. But in addition to traditional anti-Semitism, today, there's another outlet for Jew hatred that unfortunately comes up, and that is... and there's another target, big target on its back for Jew hatred, and that is, of course, the state of Israel. Ever since 1967 Six Day War, the challenges, public challenges in the international community, in the media, challenges to Israel have steadily increased. So today we're going to look at the challenges, at the claims that are made against Israel, and try to determine if the criticism is fair. Is it objective? Is it justified? And the big question, of course, can Israel somehow normalize its existence among the world family of nations? There are hundreds of nations, and one of them seems to be different than the others. Remember those old kids thing, the Highlights publication? At least when I was a kid, we had these things. And you had a circle, they had the two pictures. What's different, you know, this picture and that picture? They still have them. Okay, I figured it was a hit back then. So there's one nation that stands out, and it's Israel. Can Israel normalize its existence among the other nations? And the other question that's relevant to you and I is, what can we do here in the diaspora, here in Atlanta, Georgia, to help Israel in her current struggles? We'll explore these questions and more in today's class. The class is entitled, A Nation That Dwells Alone, Israel's Family, Israel's Relations with the Family of Nations. Okay, we're going to begin the discussion after that introduction. We're going to begin by focusing on water. Good old H2O. As many of you know, one of the major catalysts of the Six-Day War was a fight over a glass of water. You know about this? One of the major catalysts of the Six-Day War was a fight over water. And so that you can see what I'm talking about, here's our lesson video. We have a few videos today. Here's the first lesson video. It talks about Israel, Syria, and Mayim.
Water is the elixir of life, but water allocation can be a deadly affair.
In the Middle East, where temperaments mirror soaring temperatures and prejudices flow freely, the price of water is sometimes paid in blood. After the State of Israel declared independence in 1948, its leaders put their heads together to develop a water plan that would provide desperately needed fluid for drinking and irrigation purposes. Israel came up with the National Water Carrier Project, a plan to draw water from the Kinneret Lake in its north through a technically challenging network of canals, tunnels, and pipes covering a diversity of terrain and elevations, all the way down Israel's west coast to its populated center and to its parched agricultural south. The Kinneret, also known as the Sea of Galilee, is a picturesque lake in Israel's north, ringed with beaches, meadows, and mountains. It is approximately 35 miles in circumference and 150 feet at its deepest point. It held enough water to meet the demands of Israel's expanding population for decades. However, this wonderful freshwater asset is inherently fragile. It is fed mainly by the waters of the Jordan River, which originates in the gushing springs and tributaries of mountainous Lebanon and Syria. Two rivers are especially critical to the Aqaba that courses down the Jordan Valley before flowing into Lake Kinneret, the Hasbani in Lebanon, and the Banias in Syria. Without these two rivers, the Jordan's waters would drop dramatically. The Kinneret's water level would also drop, and its remaining freshwater would be irreversibly salinized by the salt springs sitting on its bed. While Israel simply wanted to have a drink, their plan drew the ire of her neighbors. Having failed to eradicate Israel in the 1948 War of Independence, the Arab world swore to at least limit her growth and economic success. Israel's water project threatened to severely undermine that goal. When Israel began construction of a national water carrier in July 1953, the war over water was set in motion. Hostilities emerged in three stages that served as stepping stones towards a full-scale Arab-Israeli conflict. As Israel's tractors bedded the soil north of the Kinneret, Syrian artillery units roared into action, bombarded the Israeli construction site. Syria demanded that the United Nations intervene against Israel. The Security Council wished to uphold Israel's right to resume work on its water project, but the Soviets vetoed the resolution. Israel modified its plan, moved its construction site further from Syria's border, and its engineers went back to work. But the dispute was just warming up. Syria and Jordan then colluded to divert the Yarmouk River. The Yarmouk would be forced to flow away from Israel and instead supplement the Jordanians' irrigation needs. United States President Eisenhower dispatched Ambassador Eric Johnston to resolve the situation. The result was the 1955 Johnston Plan, a brave attempt at coexistence and water sharing that Israel embraced and that the Arab League unofficially resolved to abide by, at least temporarily. The waves of war were thereby stilled for most of a decade. In 1964, Israel completed the National Water Carrier. It was 81 miles in length and had taken years to build at the cost of hundreds of millions of Israeli lira. But it was worth every lira. The carrier was capable of funneling an astonishing 19 million gallons of water per hour, an achievement far too great for Israel's Arab neighbors to swallow. The Arab League hastily convened in Cairo. Desperate to wreck Israel's water resource, they devised a reckless plan. The Headwater Diversion Plan called for the reduction of the water carrier's capacity by 35% by diverting its headwaters, both the Hasbani in Lebanon and the Banias in Syria, into the Yarmouk River, deep in Jordanian territory. At the same time, the Arab League clarified that this was not simply a war about liquid, but rather liquidation. Since the existence of Israel is a danger that threatens the Arab nation, the diversion of the Jordan waters by it multiplies the dangers to Arab existence. Accordingly, the Arab states have to prepare so that if necessary, results are not achieved. Collective Arab military preparations, will constitute the ultimate practical means for the final liquidation of Israel. Israel warned that the Headwater Diversion Plan would infringe on its sovereign rights. In other words, it would be considered an act of war. The Arabs, however, were not opposed to a war. They launched their project, and the skirmishes began. In 1965, there were three high-profile border clashes. The Syrian military attacked Israeli farmers and army patrols, and Israel responded by sending tanks and artillery to destroy the Arab heavy earth-moving machines that were working on the diversion plan. The Arab states eventually abandoned their project, but the war over water inspired them to plot a war of extermination against Israel. Hostilities between Israel and Syria spiraled over the next 2 years, with Syria using the Golan Heights to rain artillery upon unprotected Israeli farms and villages in the plains below. In the first quarter of 1967, there were over 270 border incidents of sabotage and attack directed against Israel. A view of the war to come came on April 7, when Syria fired at Israeli farmers. Israel responded with artillery, and the fight escalated. Israel sent planes against Syrian positions and villages, and in an ensuing aerial dogfight, Israel downed 6 Syrian fighter jets and chased the remainder all the way back to Damascus. Ariel Sharon later observed, "People generally regard June 5, 1967 as the day the Six-Day War began. That is the official date. But in reality, it started 2.5 years earlier, on the day Israel decided to act against the diversion of the Jordan River. In fact, it could be argued that the war began as soon as a parched Israel politely asked the Kinneret for a drink."
Remember what directly, right before June 5th, 1967, what immediately preceded that led to Egypt basically essentially declaring war. What was that? We talked about, huh?
Blockade of the water on the south as opposed to water on the north. You know, the blockade of the Gulf of Aqaba.
Yeah, but what happened before that? Remember the Soviets? Remember the Soviet intelligence? The Soviets gave the false information to the Egyptians that Israel was amassed on the border of Syria and prepared to attack. So Egypt says, well then, we're going in. They send out the UN peacekeeping forces in Sinai. Remember this, that kind of immediately set into motion. Why did the Soviets get involved? Because Israel knocked out their MiGs. Remember, they knocked out the... And why did they knock out the MiGs? It was part of this fight over the water. So everything is connected. And I want to tell you this. This idea of Israel's challenges about water, dealing with water, it's not anything new. In fact, it's foretold in the Torah, in the Bible itself, in the 5 books of Moses. It talks about Israel's challenges with water. Where does it say this? Let's begin. Inside the textbook, this is text number 1, page 220. And I will tell you that in this text, the Torah compares and contrasts Egypt from where the Jews were coming and Israel to where the Jews were going. Myrna, please read this, page 220, text 1. Myrna, where, yeah.
"The land into which you are entering to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have left. There you planted your seed and watered your field by bringing water from the Nile by foot like threshing parties. But the land that you are crossing the Jordan River to possess is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven."
In other words, the Torah is saying that unlike Egypt, which is irrigated, Egypt is part of what they call the Fertile Crescent, and it's irrigated by bodies of water that are naturally flowing through it. So unlike Egypt, that has that type of irrigation and things grow incredibly well, Israel is reliant upon rain from heaven. I know they were diverting the waters of the Kinneret, but that's a little bit later, right? It's a few thousand years later. But in general, Israel survives by rainfall. And this puts Israel, in a sense, in a very precarious position. In other words, if it doesn't rain, there's going to be a drought. And if there's a drought, there's usually a famine. There's no food. There's nothing to eat. In fact, when you look at the biblical narratives regarding the land of Israel, who is the first individual, the first Jew that travels, that makes Aliyah? God says, I want you to go. And he ends up in Israel. Who is that?
Abraham.
Abraham and Sarah, the first Jewish couple. They go to Israel. What happens the moment they step foot in Israel? There's a famine in the land. There's nothing to eat. There's no rain. There's no food. And they have to go. Where do they go?
Egypt.
Ironically enough, they go to Egypt. Later on, in the lifetime of his grandson, Jacob, there's also a famine. Remember, Joseph is sold. He ends up in Egypt. But meanwhile, back in Israel, or what was known then as Canaan, back in Israel, there's a famine. And ultimately, the family resettles in where? Egypt. Right? Jacob's family, 70 strong, they all settled in Egypt where they could live. The famine didn't affect them there. Again, they had the Nile. Maybe they were in denial. And they... tough crowd this afternoon. And all was good over there in Egypt. Fine. And later in the books of the prophets, post five books of Moses' times, again you find many instances of famine. The point is that Israel's challenges with water is not new. And Israel in the 1950s and 1960s trying to make a plan to survive. We need water in the big cities. We need water in the south of Israel. It's all arid. This is not a new problem. It's an old problem. With this in mind, we're going to take a look at some other new / old problems and see how these new problems are really old problems. What is the new problem I'm talking about? Let's switch gears for a second and talk about how we began the class, the world's perspective on Israel. Now, I want to begin to meet... First thing I want to say is this. There is a concept called fair and objective criticism of Israel. Israel is a nation and Israel is not perfect. And there are things that Israel does that are that perhaps shouldn't be done. Israel makes mistakes. Like every human being makes mistakes. Every nation makes mistakes. 100%. So is there a valid criticism of Israel? 100%. In fact, we've been critical of Israel in this course. And if you remember in an earlier class, we talked about the distinction between the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War. And how Israel was kind of resting on its laurels, not wanting to take a more aggressive stance, perhaps, or aggressive posture in the Yom Kippur War in 1973. And we, in this class, at least I did, maybe you agree with me, we in a sense criticized Israel and said it should have been more proactive, and because of that, it faced a lot of casualties. And there were pros and cons to each approach, whatever. The point is, there is a thing called valid criticism of Israel. The question is the criticism that we hear about in the UN, is the criticism that we hear often in the news media, are those criticisms, are they fair and objective? Let me define fair and objective. You may disagree with my definitions of fair and objective. That would be interesting, right? That my definition of fair may not be fair to you or may not be objective, but I think you'll agree. Objective means, the way we're going to define it today, fair means that you're not holding one party to a standard that you're not holding another party to. Too many double negatives there. In other words, you're holding everyone to the same standard. Same standard for all. If you call out one party for this, fair means you also call out the other party for the same thing. And if the other party gets a pass for that, well then this party also needs to get a pass for that. In other words, everyone's being held to the same standard. That's fair. Objective means that you're looking at the situation based on all the facts on the ground and you're not cherry-picking pieces of information that fit your preconceived or pre-decided, predetermined narrative. So, if you're looking at a situation, you say, well, I want the outcome to go this way. Therefore, I'm going to pull out a few facts that fit that narrative, ignore the rest, and then say, look, I've come to the conclusion. This is this because of this, and I'm omitting certain major details because I want to come to a certain conclusion. That simply is not objective. That's not looking at everything. That's only looking at certain things that I've decided to look at. So again, fair means everyone's held to the same standard. Objective means I'm looking at all the facts. You guys agree? Yes? Am I being unfair or non-objective in this definition of fair and objective? Again, that would be so meta and so interesting. Okay, good. So, with this in mind, let us look at some of the criticisms that have come up in the United Nations in the last few decades. But before we do that, let me just put it on the board. Once it's on the board, it's official. This is it. This is it. Once it's written, the written word is forever. Fair. Equal critique of all who are in violation of a consistent standard. You're holding everyone to the same standard. Objective means you follow the facts wherever they lead. You do not attempt to reconcile facts with a pre-scripted narrative. All right, now I want to show you a video. One more video. And this video will show you what's been going on in Manhattan. The east side of Manhattan. You know what's on the east side of Manhattan? United Nations. Let's take a look-see and see what our friends have been up to lately.
On the eastern shore of Manhattan Island, the United Nations headquarters rises from a row of colored flags that represent a multitude of nations. Across the avenue, the Isaiah Wall proclaims a Jewish prophet's vision of universal peace. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. The UN's mission is precisely that, to resolve armed conflicts and to foster global harmony. But inside the August chambers of the United Nations, founded in 1945 as a response to a war-ravaged world desperate for coexistence, Isaiah could have easily found himself the target of virulent condemnation had he survived into modern times. Isaiah lived in ancient Israel that for over a millennia included the territories that the UN considers illegally occupied by today's Jewish state. The Temple Mount that lies at the heart of Isaiah's prophecy is no longer considered by the UN to be the heritage or possession of the Jewish people. Indeed, the tiny country that Isaiah called home has become the focus of the majority of the UN's denunciations and has inspired more censure than all of today's tyrants put together. Iran, North Korea, and other brutal regimes systematically kill their citizens or deny them the most basic of human rights. Israel's northern neighbor, Syria, has murdered tens of thousands of innocent civilians.
The regime has also authorized the extrajudicial killing of thousands of detainees. We now believe that the Syrian regime has installed a crematorium in the Sinai prison complex, which could dispose of detainees' remains with little evidence.
Apparently, however, that isn't very important in the eyes of the UN General Assembly and Security Council, who continually pass one-sided resolutions that single out and condemn Israel. An overwhelmingly powerful bloc led by the Arab nations promotes a narrow and slanderous agenda meant to isolate Israel. This agenda has met little resistance. The UN's General Assembly votes on 70 to 100 resolutions annually. 15 to 20 of these regularly express disapproval of Israel. From 2012 through 2015, the Assembly adopted 97 resolutions criticizing various countries. 83 of these targeted Israel. That's 86% of all country-specific resolutions. A closer look at the Assembly's score sheet reveals that year after year, less than a quarter of its measures censure countries other than Israel. And while three-quarters of this global forum's written rage lambastes the Jewish state, precious few of the most repressive or blood-soaked regimes on earth have received even a single rebuke. Emergency special sessions of the Assembly are rare. During the last 15 years, they've been convened for one purpose only, to condemn Israel. The Assembly's embrace of a terrorist entity has been equally astounding. In October 1974, 14 years before the Palestinian Liberation Organization even nominally forswore terrorism, the Assembly voted to invite a PLO spokesman to take part in its deliberations. This was the first time that anyone who is neither a government representative nor a head of a quasi-state was granted such a privilege. The Assembly awarded the PLO permanent representative status. A few months later, the UN infamously approved Resolution 3379, branding Zionism as a form of racism. At the time, Israel's UN ambassador, Chaim Herzog, told his fellow delegates that Hitler would have felt at home listening to the UN debate on the measure.
For us, the Jewish people, this is no more than a piece of paper, and we shall treat it as such.
Since the 1993 Oslo Accords, hundreds of Israelis have been killed and thousands injured by Palestinian terror attacks. During the same period, the UN passed dozens of resolutions deploring Israel, but not one against the terror attacks. Since the 2006 creation of the UN's Human Rights Council, most of the world's human rights abusers have suffered nary a mild rebuke. Israel, on the other hand, is chastised as often as all of the rest of the countries combined, and in turns more condemnatory. At the Council's every meeting, a topic billed as, quote, human rights situation in Palestine and other occupied Arab territories is raised as a separate agenda item, while the remaining totality of mankind constitutes a single other point on the agenda. From 2006 to 2013, Israel was condemned in no less than 45 Human Rights Council resolutions. That is almost half, 45.9% of all country-specific resolutions passed by the Council. This same obsession with censoring Israel is found in all branches of the United Nations. At the UN's World Health Organization Annual Assembly in Geneva in 2005, the body passed but a single resolution against a specific country. That's right, Israel. Israel was charged with violating Palestinian health rights. Similarly, at the International Labour Organization's annual conference in Geneva in 2005, the organization carried only one major country-specific report on its annual agenda. No prizes for guessing its identity. A lengthy document charged Israel with violating the rights of Palestinian workers. Even within the walls of the UN, the absurdity of its anti-Israel bias is fleetingly, partially acknowledged. In September 2006, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan conceded,
"Supporters of Israel feel that it is harshly judged by standards that are not applied to its enemies. And too often this is true, particularly in some UN bodies."
In August 2013, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reflected on Israel's treatment of the UN.
"There are some rights that are those of Israel,
In December 2016, he told the UN Security Council,
"A disproportionate volume of resolutions, reports, and conferences criticizing Israel."
One of the more telling comments came inadvertently in November 2013, when a UN interpreter failed to silence her microphone as she addressed her colleague.
I think when you have a total of 10 resolutions on Israel and Palestine, there's got to be something. It's not the, there's, I think, really bad happening, nobody says anything, but the other stuff. Apologies.
Okay, I understand there was a problem with interpretation.
Israel is not larger than 8,019 square miles in total. It is the Middle East's only functioning democracy and champion of human rights. It is a world provider of humanitarian disaster relief and medical, agricultural, ecological, scientific, technological, and security innovations. But when seen through the lens of historical UN bias, the overwhelming majority of all the world's evils and all of the world's ills belong to the tiny Jewish homeland in which Isaiah spoke his vision of swords being beaten into plowshares.
All right, so the cool thing about that not if cool is the right word, but all of that is official public record. There's nothing that's pulled out of the record. All of that, it's all the facts of how many resolutions have been passed, how many target Israel, how many condemn Israel, etc. When you see this, when you see the numbers, the sheer numbers of condemnations, of resolutions, of measures of passed against Israel, versus what's going on in the rest of the world, North Korea, you know, they just sent home this this young man, Otto, I forgot his last name, this 22-year-old man, young man who passed away a few days after he got back home. Terrible tragedy. Did you anybody hear the UN convene an emergency session to condemn North Korea? Did anybody think of that, that should happen? Did anyone say, this is terrible, North Korea did something reprehensible? In April of 2016, they knew that this man had suffered a serious brain injury. What's been happening over the last year and a few months? Where have they been? Why didn't they let him home then at least? What's going on? Did anyone think, in their personal outrage perhaps, if you were outraged, I'm assuming that you might have been, so in your personal affront to the injustice that happened, did you even once think, hey, the UN really should get involved in this? Did anyone think that? Ask yourself why. Ask, what does the UN do? According to this, it disproportionately condemns Israel. So what I want to point out is, based on the measure of fairness, when you have a world that is so often so messed up. Syria is gassing chemical warfare against its own people. That was the red line that was crossed. And then nothing happened, right? The world is watching what's going on and the other genocide, the other issues that are going on. The fact that the majority, that a big number of resolutions, the Security Council, the General Assembly, should be passed targeting, focused on Israel, defies explanation. And even the security, the Kofi Annan and Kim Bae-yoon, whatever the new guy. So even they acknowledge at least a little bit that there seems to be a bias. So when we talk about I'm sure there was some sort of justification, but at least there's some sort of acknowledgement. My point is therefore not saying that everything's cool. My point is saying, let's understand that for somebody to come to the conclusion and say, you know what, the UN seems a bit prejudiced, a bit biased against Israel. These are the facts. This is the public record. These are the documents that has been produced by this body in Manhattan. This is what's coming out. This is the literature that's being published, that's being put out. This is the fact, these are the facts on the ground. Somebody to say that it points to a bias or prejudice against Israel, or basically, this is unfair because we're not holding the world and the other nations to the same standard that we're holding Israel to. For somebody to come to that conclusion, and this is a really long sentence, I think is indeed fair.
You know what Nikki Haley did?
Could be. I'm not sure. But I want to mention something else. When you look at fairness, I don't think you can see fairness. I don't see even criticism or even condemnation. I see vilification. I see a country being targeted and being just absolutely ripped to shreds in a way that others aren't held to.
The final moves of the Obama administration in
the U.S. Listen, so here's the thing. We can talk about that. I don't want it to become a political,
but the United States.
Good. Listen, we can talk about that. I want to focus on two things, the United Nations and the media. We can discuss that as a third point, maybe after the class, but I think that may hit political stuff, and I want to avoid it because that can take the conversation in a different direction. I want to focus it here. I'm not commenting on what you're saying directly. What I'm saying is let's hold that to an after class discussion. Now, let's take a look at the media. Text 2A, I don't know that I want to read it, only because it's a long text, and it's a really important text, and in fact, the entire article published in 2014 is printed in the back of your lesson, in the book that you have, so you can read the whole thing, and then an excerpt is 2A, but it's still a little bit too long for my taste. So I want to paraphrase what it says, And to make sure that I'm being fair and objective to the text, you can look it up as I speak or you can look it up later. But here's what he says. This is a man, Mari Friedman, who was a reporter and an editor in the Jerusalem Bureau of the Associated Press from the years 2006 to 2011. What he writes is that the coverage that comes out of the Middle East, the coverage that comes out of Israel, published by big news organizations like the AP, the Associated Press, is not at all objective. They're pulling out pieces of information and omitting major pieces of information. For example, he says, there was no reports in the AP about Hamas, which is a terrorist organization that was voted into power in Gaza. There's no mention in the AP, or there was no mention in his time, about them entrenching themselves in civilian neighborhoods. They were setting up shop in civilian populated areas. Before the Gaza war broke out, they were setting up. But this wasn't reported, even though it would have been newsworthy as kind of setting up what may be a disaster because of it. You understand what I'm saying? And then he further says, when the war was being reported on, and the Associated Press reporters in Gaza knew that the civilian counts, the civilian death counts being reported by the Palestinians in Gaza, they were being padded because Hamas terrorists were dressed as civilians and they were counting them as civilians. The reporters knew this, they didn't publish it. They didn't write it. They cited fear of safety of the reporters that were in Gaza. They got threats that they dare not report this fact, these issues. But at least report that it's a censor. He writes, they didn't even report it as it's a censored article. They wrote it as though, you know, the facts are Israel killed this number of civilians and that's it. So what his point is, and again, it's worthwhile, and the Hebrew word is kedai, it's worthwhile to read it in its entirety. It'll give you a picture of somebody who was in Israel, who was in the Jerusalem Bureau of the Associated Press, reporting it. He writes himself, he couldn't write certain things. He wasn't allowed to. He wasn't going to get published. So here's the point. The news that comes out of the Middle East, the news that comes out of Israel, is not always objective. Oftentimes, there's a narrative that's pieced together based on only certain pieces of information and not the whole picture. So if you read about civilian casualties and you read about disproportionate response because so many civilians are dying, questions that you need to ask yourself. If it's really objective, number one, are the terrorists or the enemies lying in embedded in civilian populations? Number two, are those really civilians and not terrorists in plain clothes? And number three, you have to ask yourself, why is that not mentioned? And I want to mention something else. First of all, you understand where we're going with this? As far as cherry picking certain pieces of information and omitting others, even if you have a good reason, but not telling the readership that you're omitting certain pieces and presenting it as the full picture, but it's not, okay, that's a problem. But I want to mention, and I'm not saying that all media is terrible. We need media. Media is good, because without media, there's less transparency. We need more transparency, not less transparency. But we also have to be ready to call out media when it's not transparent, or more precisely, when it's not being objective or fair. I want to mention something else. As of June 1st, 2017, 3 weeks ago, reports came out of Iraq saying that the Iraqis that are fighting to recapture Mosul from ISIS. ISIS has captured Mosul in Iraq a little while ago. And now the Iraqi forces, the soldiers trained, you know, together with some American help and other international help, they're fighting to recapture Mosul. Did anybody hear this? In June 1st, 2017, 3 weeks ago, reports came out that in 6 days of fighting, only 6 days, now it's much longer than six, but in the last 6 days of fighting, 150 innocent civilians in Mosul were killed. Anybody hear that?
Big story, really.
Huge story, right? Anybody hear that? You heard that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jewish Times subscription.
That's it. You don't hear it. But you certainly hear when Israel, and I'm not justifying, again, this is not a justification for civilian casualties. Again, how to fight a war in the best way, that's its own class, and we have to have a conversation about that. But the concept of Israel being held up to a certain standard, and when there's any civilian casualties, no way, you gotta stop the war, let the terrorists be, because innocent people are dying. Do we hold other nations to the same degree of accountability? Is it a fair standard, or is it one nation that's held to one standard and the rest of the nations held to a completely different standard? That's the question that I'm asking. I'm not saying whether civilian casualties are not a bad thing or a terrible thing. That's not the question. The question is, are the same standards being applied across the board? Make sense? And what I'm positing today is that it's not. All too often, it's not the same standard. And yes, there are reports that say it's terrible that civilians are dying or being killed in the fighting in Mosul and Iraq. You do have that. But where's the international uproar that you don't have? Where's the international uproar against from formal bodies against North Korea? Okay, so that's where we're at right now. And therefore, it's, I think, for somebody to come to the conclusion and say, you know what? There seems to be a big target on the back of Israel, a target that other nations, other countries don't have. For someone to come to that conclusion, I think, is not far-fetched. It's not paranoid, but it reflects an accurate record of what's being put out by the United Nations and what appears in various news publications by the media. Questions, comments? I know we said a lot of heavy things, yeah.
Quick comment, I don't want to get into too much, it'll take us too far off. But even the way we talk about these issues, because we're speaking into a limited media report, because it looks like Israel might be doing bad,
right.
We bend over backwards to say, well, Israel, no, the country is perfect. But we bend over backwards to, you know, to
apologetics.
To be apologetic about the whole thing.
Right.
And it's crazy.
When maybe, right, in other words, we're defensive and we're apologetic and embarrassed, it could be that the news that's hitting is actually not even portraying the facts. Remember the massacre in Jenin? You guys remember that?
Yeah.
Years ago. When I was a kid. Whatever. Right, not that long ago. Right, there's a massacre in Jenin. And there was a number that was put out initially, like, I don't want to misstate the number, but a huge number. And then it came out later, listen, not that no one lost their life, no civilians, 100% yes. Nonetheless, it wasn't that number, and the outrage at the number was just... So sometimes we hear it, and we start apologizing. And we start, you know, well, you know, it's not perfect, you're right, we should really look into that. Meanwhile, is it actually factual? And how do we know? Again, the more troubling piece from Friedman's article from 2014, to me, one of the more troubling pieces there is that they will not mention, if Israel censors the article, they'll say that. If other nations, you know, are controlling the information, they'll write somewhere, you know, that this was, somewhere they'll write that this was, you know, censored or whatever. But when it's done, when it's coming from Gaza, then they won't do that. And they can cite safety concerns, but they're not doing that, and it's just straight up being misrepresented. Anybody else? I think there was some more. Yeah.
I believe that what we would like coming from the other nations has to begin with us, the Jewish people, no matter where we live. We need to subscribe to Jewish newspapers. And that, you know, whether
it's... Good. It's a practical suggestion. I like it. I'm going to mention it. We're going to go maybe in a little bit of a different direction as far as what we can do. But not to discount that. I think that's a good, that's to get, we should make sure that we're allowing ourselves to hear more than one side of a story. We're giving ourselves all the information. Yeah.
with the understanding that emotion trumps reason.
Yes.
Every time.
You sure?
It feels to me as the kid in elementary school, and somebody posted a kick me sign.
Right.
On his back.
Yep.
What makes Israel,
yep,
this tiny, insignificant,
the target,
country that doesn't affect anything about the Arab life at all, in practical terms?
Right.
What makes Israel such a target for the entire entire world?
That's a big question. That's the million dollar question. That's actually where I was going to next. What is it? Why? So where is this coming from? Why? Here's my perspective on it. And I hope you're open to what I'm about to say. You know, some people might say, you know, well, what did Israel do wrong? I mean, if you have a kick me sign on it, then maybe you did something wrong. Was it 1948? Is it 1967? Is it Israel's success? Is it that it's a democracy in that area? Why the target on its back? Why the international target? What did it do wrong? But that's victim blaming. That's saying, well, someone's a victim. Why, you know, what did they do wrong? What's the, you know, and that, I don't think that's a healthy place. And I also think that trying to analyze it in that type of approach, the one that I just mentioned, that I suggested, takes a very narrow view of history and it's a narrow and naive look at history. You see, as I mentioned at the beginning of the class, tragically, unfortunately, the idea of anti-Jewish bias or Jewish hate, or anti-Semitism, whatever you prefer, whatever language you prefer, that is one of the world's oldest pastimes. It's existed from the beginning of our peoplehood. Egypt, other nations, I mean, we can go through the list, but pretty much almost every country where Jews were, at some point in time, that nation turned against the Jewish people. We'll mention a few. What are some of the countries? So Egypt, Greece, Rome, Spain, England, France, Austria, Hungary, Russia, Germany, Poland, and many other countries not mentioned, directly or indirectly took action against Jews and or their own Jewish populace. There have been expulsions. You know that I'm sure you all know that in England, Jews were expelled for over 400 years. Jews were not allowed to live in England. Jews were expelled, of course, from Spain and from Portugal and from other countries, and otherwise Jews were given a hard time and whole communities were routed. And so the question of why Israel, to me, takes a very myopic view of history. Really the question is, well, I don't know if the question, really what it comes down to is this is another step in this pattern of anti-Jewish focus. In other words, Jews have been targeted for 3,000 years. Is it really that surprising? And again, this is all recorded, well documented in history. There's an expulsion of Jews on average every 50 years. If you look through history, you have in your books, turn to page 220, I want to say 228, and you'll see right there, there's a spread, 228. And you'll see there's a spread there of notable incidents of anti-Jewish prejudice and violence throughout history, starting from 1429 BCE, which starts at the bottom. It's a little bit counterintuitive there, but the bottom left, going all the way to 2008 in Mumbai, and you see some of the more noticeable incidents. And there are many, countless more incidents that are not on this page. And so you ask the question, is it that surprising, and hear how I phrase this, is it really that surprising that the one Jewish state in the world is the one that's the most condemned? Is that really surprising given the patterns of history? You can say, I don't want to know about history. Don't get me involved in history and historical anti-Semitism. That's old. Let's figure out why right now is Israel so maligned. To me, that's like, I don't know. I'm not saying that was your question. What I'm saying is, my answer to your question is, I see, and I hope that you're a little open to this perspective, that a lot of the targeting of Israel has to do with it being the Jewish state. And it's all part of this pattern of Jewish targeting throughout history. Here's a proof, and I use air quotes with proof, but here's maybe an indication that what I'm saying is accurate. You know, when Israel is in the news, being portrayed negatively, like in 2014 with the Gaza war, from Gaza, Hamas is lobbing rockets and missiles into Israel, so Israel fights back, and you know, Israel, thank God, has a solid military, so it's causing some pushback. So Israel is in the media, Israel is in the news, and it's being oftentimes portrayed as the villain. what happens in 2014. You can look it up. You know, many websites that are about this, that talk about this. You have documented dozens and dozens of anti-Semitic incidents. Synagogues that are firebombed. Jewish centers that are targeted with swastikas. Rabbis' homes that are targeted as well. You have incident after incident, and this begs a question. If you have an issue, if you're upset about Israel and Gaza, but you don't like what Israel is doing, why are you targeting a synagogue in France? What does a synagogue in France have to do with the Israeli government? You understand my question? In other words, think about it. You have an issue with Israel. Let's say you believe it's a legitimate issue. Okay. Protest Israel. Hold signs against Israel. Why are you going after religious-looking Jews and beating them up? Right? Why is that happening? It's happening because what this points to is that a lot of the hate toward Israel is really a hatred toward Jews and Judaism. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Take a look at an art. Yeah.
You're saying that anti-Semitism has been around, ebbing and flowing for 2,000 years.
Yes.
So is it fair to assume that anti-Semitism will be around for the next 3,000 years and ebb and flow?
Great question.
Is it fair to say that?
We're going to get to that question of like what to do with anti-Semitism. In other words, what do we do about it?
Well, I'm not even there yet, but I'm just saying, is it fair to say there isn't a date preordained in the Bible that says from this date on, that's the end of it?
No, unfortunately not. In fact,
if that's the case, why is it different in this day and age? Why is anti-Semitism different? Your premise is it's really not different. It's morphed.
Right.
Okay. And I'm saying, what if there was never a state of Israel up till now, up till, 70 years?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could argue that if there wasn't a state of Israel, you might still have a flourishing Jewish population. I'm not, God forbid, but I'm saying you might still have a flourishing population. Most of us living in the United States, fat, dumb, and happy. What's the problem?
Right.
So, to my question is, to what extent do you think there's an added burden if they're both anti-Semitism at the root? Is the quote state?
Yeah, I agree with what. I agree with the premise of your question. I do believe that formalizing a state does put a target and makes it a formal target. However, what's the alternative? Is it to pack up and go home and let go? You should know before 1948, the Jews living in Israel were pretty much constantly targeted by terrorist activities. There were massacres. No.
I didn't even suggest that.
No, I understand. What I'm saying is, I think that it creates a formal, target,
focal point,
it's the same stuff. Would it, without that focal point, would it come out in increased measure in other ways? I think yes, unfortunately. But what you're pointing out, I think, is a valid thing to consider in this discussion.
The counter to that, though, is that, talking about the United States, Israel has added a credibility to Jews around the world.
Right.
European stereotypes, the money lender, merchant of Venice, those type of stereotypes have all been done away with, largely in part of Israel.
Right.
I even say the rise of Jews in American politics, Jews in American military, and all this is somewhat tied into.
Yeah.
So we're having a benefit from that.
There is a benefit. I would say, though, together with that benefit, with the BDS movement, which is about boycotting Israel, you have a lot of people that are saying Israel's technology, who wants it? Who needs it? Israel's academia, Israel's scientists, not invited to this conference. It's a terrible, terribly frightening movement that, I'm not saying goes against your point, but provides a little bit of a pushback to where maybe not all of the world fully respects Israel's accomplishments. And some say, you know what, accomplishments, we don't want it, we don't need it, we don't think that you're legitimate at all, and therefore we're going to throw everything away. Now, of course, the joke is, they get rid of your Intel computer and get rid of Waze and get rid of... I get it, right? I mean, you can't, but nonetheless, there are those that are still holding strong and saying, no, 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 I don't want to see it, I don't want to hear it. Don't tell me Israel's legitimate based on these accomplishments. I don't even want their accomplishments. To the second point, I forgot the second point. Okay, yeah.
Yes. Good one.
It's probably mediocre, yeah.
As a rebuttal to your argument, which I do not agree with, your argument is that the establishment of Israel has aggravated anti-Semitism generally from stories from my uncles in the 1930s.
Yeah.
We all know the story. They couldn't work for major corporations. They were excluded from prestigious universities.
Where? Here?
Here. In the U.S.
Yep.
And so you cannot say because of Israel, anti-Semitism has been aggravated in America and universally. It was just as great, if not more severe back then.
Wait, no. But here's the question. Has Israel made it less? Has Israel's success or existence made anti-Semitism in America less today? So here's the thing. I think, that was actually the second point. I believe that we are, in general, in America, we are less prejudiced, racist, anti-Semitic here. I think more or less than in the past. And you can look at local, I was eavesdropping on some conversation about Decatur, and we know about Avondale's history. Okay, there's some stuff here locally and lynchings, etc. Fine. But beyond that, I want to point out, I keep on forgetting this point. How crazy is that? The point of Israel, of the prejudice. What was your second point, Aaron? Help me out here.
I said that Israel has enhanced the position of the Jew, I think.
That's what I wanted to say. When you look at Germany, you look at Spain centuries ago, and Germany 80 years ago, you start realizing that to be safe and to be comfortable, to be may not be the best approach. I'm not predicting doom and gloom. What I'm saying is, the German Jews also thought they were too big to fail. There is no way this nation is going to turn against us. Us, we're the scientists, we're the doctors, we're the musicians, we're the composers, we're the artists. There's no way that we're going to get taken down. Germany, the Jews in Germany, there was a movement to be more German than the Germans. We know how that ended. Well, I'm not suggesting, therefore, we should all be panicked here in America, notwithstanding our integration within society. What I am suggesting is that based on history, and it's a mistake to not look at history, that's a huge mistake, we all know this, right? Based on history and recent history, we know that full integration in society on all levels means nothing to guarantee security. It's not a guarantee. Does it help? Is it a good move? Again, that could be discussed and debated. Is it a guarantee? Huh. Not a chance. I mean, we know that it's not a chance. So that's, again, a bit of a counter to that idea. We're making good strides, however. Now, I want to point out text number 7. I love text 7. Yeah.
Can I just get a footnote in?
Yes, please.
Talk about Ireland and the Jews. Here's a dinky little country.
Right.
Snakes are gone. Patrick's taking care of that. There was a bad time in 1904. But some pretty good things happened in Ireland with the Jews. The first rabbi for Israel came from there. Mayors came from there. A lot of things happened, which makes it hard to say that if things are going well, it's necessarily going to go bad.
Correct.
But it is historically that way in most places.
Right.
And the last part of the footnote is, when things have gone bad for 2,000 years, let's take the Catholic Church and Jews, when something goes good, we should at least add the footnote.
Yes, 100%.
It's hard to do,
right,
because we got 1,800 years of bad.
Right. Right.
That, if we don't add the footnote, then we basically can be alarmed every time there's
correct.
A turn.
Correct. Correct. Thank you for pointing that out. So I want to mention a few points on that. Number one, I'm not that familiar with Ireland and the history of Jews in Ireland, but it sounds to me like it's a great thing. I did not intend to suggest, based on Germany, 1930s and 1940s, that success is a causation of genocide, but rather that on the other way, it's not a guarantee against it. So just to clarify that point, and 100% we should acknowledge and be very appreciative for the liberties that we have and the freedoms that we have in this United States, and we should cherish them and fight for them and not do everything we can to not let them go, because it is a blessing. And in fact, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, when he came to America in 1940, he composed a prayer for the government that is recited in synagogues. So there is certainly, for the United States government, so there's certainly an incredible measure of thanks that we need to have for what we have. At the same time, you know, thank you for providing the balance. At the same time, you know, we have to be careful. Now, Ray, if you don't mind, reading text number 7, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, I want to make sure to get this text in, even though we're kind of paraphrasing a lot of the discussion. This one talks about how it can be, how anti-Israel sentiment today can be understood as an evolved form of anti-Semitism, considering the following points. This is from a larger piece. It is so worthwhile to read up in the original, you can Google this. He has a talk where there's a video of this talk. Okay, it's very important, and we had discussed this, it's very important to understand what he's saying, what he's arguing. And again, just be open to this argument, that his point is anti-Semitism evolves like a virus. Every time you put up a wall, it finds a way around it. And it always goes after what is in vogue at the time. So when religion is all the rage, well, what's the problem with the Jews? They're the wrong religion. Right? Or they killed, you know, whatever, etc. When science is all the rage, well, Jews are scientifically flawed. And when human rights are all the rage, which is the age we're living in today, it's all about human rights, right? We're all open to... When human rights are all the rage, what's the problem with the Jews? They're the worst human rights violators. This is language that you didn't hear before. Language you didn't hear. When it's about the money, we're the worst with the money. When it's always being... the argument's always shifting. And so here's my point. And here's the point that's being mentioned here. Just to reiterate and then to advance it a bit. To look at Israel and ask the question, why is Israel targeted? In my opinion, is really requires us to take a step back and ask the question, why are Jews targeted? Why have we been targeted throughout all these centuries and millennia? Because the Jewish state, the fact that the one tiny Jewish state in the world is the most criticized by the world in the context of the world targeting Jews for millennia, is not that surprising. The question is, what do we do? Why is that a reality that Jews have been targeted forever, and what do we do about that? So, here's the deal. When you look at the scientific, we just mentioned science, you look at the scientific method, the process of doing experiments and trying to change things up and see if you're going to come to the same result. If you change a bunch of factors, but every time you do the experiment, it still gets the same result, and you're changing out one factor, you change it again, you swap it out, then what you know is that those factors that you're swapping out are not a critical factor for the result. You're with me on that? I'm not using the correct scientific terms, but the point is, if you're switching... Yeah.
It occurs to me, just as I look at that sign up there, we have two challenges.
Yeah.
All of the Arab world is anti-Israel. I don't think the Americans and the Germans and French are anti-Israel, they're anti-Semites. And so it's kind of...
We're dealing with both.
If we can make Israel more perfect in the world's view, it would be good. It's not going to change any of the anti-Semitism. Yeah.
Okay, good, good, good point. So, and I think that's a worthy takeaway from this discussion is what can Israel do to certainly better herself? Yes.
Rabbi, well, just a side note. I was once in Portugal, and the Portuguese guy told me there was no anti-Semitism in Portugal. And I said, "Well, how many Jews are in Portugal?" He said, "Not many."
Yeah. So, there are certain places in Spain that still don't have any Jews today. Good to know. It's fine. Yeah, I mean, it's nice. Hey, listen, here's the deal. You look at all of the conditions of anti-Semitism, and there's a wonderful text that, again, I don't know that we have the time to read it inside, but there's a text that talks about, I want to say it's text number 6, yeah, from Rabbi Menachem Zemba, who was killed in the Holocaust. Anyway, he was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto. That text suggests the following. We've been hated because we're rich and took all the money. We've been hated because we were poor and were, the parasites. We've been hated because we were the capitalists. We've been hated because we were the communists, socialists. We've been hated because we were too religious and separate. We've been hated because we've been too assimilated. And who are you trying to fool? And you start swapping out everything. And you start also swapping out location and era. And all of those things keep on changing, but there's one constant result, and that is people hate us. And you start realizing, wait a second, it's not because we're successful, because when we're not successful, it's also no good. It's not because we're capitalist, the political, because when we're socialist, it's also not good. It's not because we're in this country, because we're in that country, it's also no good. So what is it? Here's the point. I don't know. You don't know either. What I do know is that our survival is based on one factor. Take a look at text number 10. Yes.
Rabbi Sacks and what you talked about is saying that anti-Semitism more in terms of virus is mutated.
Yes.
Okay. It's interesting that you could make the argument that the Jewish people through all this time didn't mutate.
Right.
And it's surprising that
it
survived without doing mutation.
Oh, that's what we're getting to right now.
Yeah, but he did.
Well, no. I mean, you're talking about... Hold on. No, I think what Mark is saying is that the Jew committed to his or her faith, that's been a constant. Moses, it's been often said, would be at home in Jerusalem today. Moses would say, hey, I'm coming back after 3,000 years. You have a pair of tefillin that I can put on? Sure, come into the shul. And you have a Torah scroll? Yeah, we got it right here. And you got a mezuzah on the door? Yeah, we got the same stuff. Imagine Julius Caesar coming in. Hey, how the Romans doing? You got a toga for me? I don't know, do they wear togas? Can't find the chariot. What's going on? Judaism is a constant, hasn't mutated. And the question is, well, how have we survived? Text 10 from the Midrash. Tom, please read this one. Text 10 is the powerful text. In my opinion, is the text of the day.
The Roman Emperor Hadrian said to Rabbi Yehoshua, "Great is the sheep that survives in the midst of 70 wolves." Rabbi Yehoshua responded, "Great is the shepherd who saves the sheep, protects it, and vanquishes the wolves that wish to attack it."
This Hadrian was a friend of the Jews before he wasn't, and he was brutal later on in his life. This is before he got that violence. And he has a good relationship with Rabbi Yeshua. He says, "You know what? The sheep is so amazing. It survives What's the one sheep amongst the 70 wolves? The 70 is significant. The Torah says in Genesis, there's 70 nations. So what's the one sheep amongst the 70 wolves? It's the Jewish people amongst the nations. He says, wow, that sheep is so amazing, so skilled at survival. And the rabbi says, you think it's the sheep? It's not the sheep. Sheep hasn't had, the sheep doesn't have a chance. Why is the sheep still around? There's a shepherd with a capital S. There's a shepherd that's protecting the sheep. And you might say, well, where's the shepherd? And how come there wasn't a shepherd? Okay, lots of good questions. But this is what the Midrash is teaching us. And we are still here after everything. We're still here right now in a synagogue in Virginia Highlands, in Atlanta, studying a Midrashic text. We are still around. We literally, you and I are still here. And this is what we're studying. And the message is, from this Midrash that we're studying and we're living, there is a shepherd that's watched us. So why anti-Semitism? What could we change about Israel to make us more desirable? Should we be even a bigger democracy? And say, we are the only democracy in the Middle East. Look how democratic we are. Is that really going to help? Is it going to help? And we say, but wait. We're so smart. We have the exoskeleton thing, the exoskeletal suit that you people that are, God forbid, paralyzed, they can't walk, they can walk in it. Israel is so amazing. Look at Haiti. Israel sets up this mobile hospital. We're so, don't you love us now? And the world says, some say yes. We can't, again, we don't want to be paint everybody with one brush. But many still say, no, still don't like you. To try to figure out why and what we can do to make ourselves look prettier, to me, is a fool's errand, because it's never going to work. History tells us, you try to change this, try to change your political view, your financial standing, your religious affiliation, or your religious degree of, you know, of observance, that ain't going to work. You want to be more German than the Germans? Hitler will still hunt that person down. Still not going to work. So then what are we left with? Appeasing those that may still hate us, or turning to the shepherd? I think from a rabbi, after that buildup, you know my answer, right? We need to focus on the shepherd, which, and therefore I want to put the whole Six-Day War in a certain context. And hear me out. 2 days before the war started, May 3rd, 1967, 2 days before the war started, in Brooklyn, New York, we saw the video last week of the Rebbe at the parade, at the Lag BaOmer parade, saying Israel has nothing to worry about, God is watching. Okay, 2 days before the war, the Rebbe, some of you know this, launched a worldwide tefillin campaign, wrapping tefillin. Israeli soldiers in the IDF in Israel should wrap tefillin. Men in Israel should wrap tefillin. Around the world, a global campaign. In 1967 alone, 400,000 men wrapped tefillin in honor of this campaign, both before and after the war, granted. But in 1967, 400,000 Jews wrapped tefillin. And the Rebbe said when he launched this campaign, he said, there is a verse that says the nations will see the name of God upon you and they will fear you. And the commentaries explain, not the commentaries, I'm sorry. Text 14, the Talmud says, you know what, let's read this. Joel, please read text 14, page 241.
All the nations of the earth will see that God's name is invoked upon you and they will fear you. It was taught that Rabbi Eliezer the Great said, this is a reference to the stone of the head upon which the name of God is written.
And the Rebbe quoted this passage from the Talmud and he said, put on tefillin, they will be afraid. We know that in the Six-Day War, those that sought to destroy Israel and the Jewish people, or the Jewish people in Israel, they ran away in irrational fear. One tank makes a wrong turn. A whole brigade runs away. Oh, the Israelis are coming. Seized with irrational fear, running away in all directions, leaving their shoes. We've seen the videos. They left their shoes in the sand. They ran so fast. Defying all protocol of retreat. Chaos. The Rebbe, 2 days before the war, said, we're going to start this campaign. Wrap tefillin, because God's promise is, you wrap tefillin in honor of that mitzvah. Those that wish to harm you, they will be afraid of you. There also, I heard reports, I wasn't there, I can't confirm it, but I've heard reports that at some parts of the battle, they saw Israeli soldiers wearing tefillin, and the word was, this must be new armaments from America, we got to get out of here. They were afraid from literally seeing the tefillin, let alone the spiritual aura. So if I told you that part of, a major part of Israel's miraculous victory was the spiritual currency, the spiritual protection that they got by focusing on the shepherd, not trying to appease the wolves, but focusing on the shepherd, and that in the merit of this incredible mitzvah, it's all about protection and fear for the enemy, that in the merit of this mitzvah, Israel miraculously won the war. If I told you that, would you believe it?
Yes, sir.
I'll ask you this. Do you have a better explanation for it? Why not? Right? So here's what I want to say in conclusion. And we're going to wrap it up, then we'll take more questions. Here's what I want to say in conclusion. We today, Jews around the world, as good as things are in certain places, you know, Jews in Israel, Israel itself stands at, you know, is standing pretty much constantly in somewhat of a precarious position in the world, in media, safety, security, etc. We have the Iron Dome, we have lots of amazing things. At the end of the day, a sheep cannot survive without the shepherd. And it behooves the sheep, not to mix animals, right? It behooves the sheep to remember, said tough crowd, to remember the shepherd and to not forget where the protection is really coming from. We need AIPAC, we need diplomacy, we need all of the, we need the technology, we need the science, we need the arms, we need the planes, we need everything. But we also need the spiritual protection. And that happens when we acknowledge God Almighty. We say thank you for God Almighty, to God Almighty for all the blessings that we have. And we ask for continued protection. And we remember that really it's all about God watching the land, which is why, getting back to the beginning of the class, which is why God says, I'm going to put you in the one in a land that needs the rain. You know why? Because God wants us to look up heavenward and pray for the rain. Without the rain, it doesn't grow. You can't eat. Until we figure out how to channel the water. Okay, fine, but forget that for a second. But for thousands of years, you need the rain. God says, I don't want you to live a life in which you'll forget about me. God says, I want you to remember, because your existence, your very existence is based on this connection, on this memory, on this acknowledgement. So what can we do in Atlanta for Israel? Each of us can do more spiritual stuff. In addition to the other diplomatic stuff and the other avenues that we might want to do and write letters and volunteer and visit Israel, all that stuff is great. But what can we do right now to create a spirit, to create an increase in Israel's protection? If we believe the Talmud, that the existence of the Jewish people and of Israel, and we believe the Torah that says that Israel exists because God's eyes are upon the land. If we believe that, and I hope we do, then we'll come to the conclusion that there are things that we can do today, right now, spiritually, that can serve in good stead for all of us and for our brothers and sisters in the land of Israel. So, for men, we can wrap tefillin, even once, maybe take a commitment more often, whatever. Women, Shabbat candles. Tefillin, as I said, creates fear. Shabbat candles, Neirot, Shabbat Kodesh, the Hebrew words of Shabbat candles. You put it together, it forms the word Neshek. Neshek in Hebrew also means
weapons.
So there was a story, a Chabadnik was going to Israel with a bunch of kits of candle, you know, candles that, to give out to people to light candles. And they asked him, at the customs in Israel, what do you have? What's in the suitcase? Neshek. Oh, they call it security. You have guns and weapons. No, no, no. The spiritual version. It's a spiritual weaponry. Light. Bring light into the world. So tefillin, Shabbat candles, and of course, mezuzah. Mezuzah, you put it up on the door of your home, and it protects inside and outside, when you're at home, when you're away, you and others. These are three mitzvahs that I selected. You could select whatever you want, but these are three mitzvahs that I feel are very appropriate in this context. So, we're all hoping for the time when God fulfills His promise, and let us indeed storm the heavens and ask God to fulfill that promise, the promise that we saw from Isaiah. Was it Isaiah? Jeremiah, Isaiah, they all spoke about the same thing. But that one was from Isaiah, about the beating the swords into plowshares, may we experience the time that God promised us through his prophets, that a time when no nation will raise arms against another nation, and there will be peace upon the earth. No wars, no hatred, no fighting. May peace prevail for eternity, speedily in our days, and let us say, Amen. Thank you very much for joining me for the class.